From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Who are the pioneers of computer technology? In some instances, they are known only to the readers of Business Week and the Wall Street Journal. Today we'll talk with two American engineers who went on to start up and establish successful publicly traded international companies. Edson DeCastro has been called the father of the mini computer. He's founder and former CEO of Data General Corporation. He'll recount Data General's evolution as well as tell us about his current ventures in biotechnology. I'll also talk with Al Shugart. He founded Seagate Technology, the world's leading manufacturer of disks and disk drives. We'll talk about how Seagate got its start and their plans for the future. Edson DeCastro worked on computer technology in the 1960s, just as large mainframe computers were starting their relentless march into miniaturization. At the time, a computer meant very large, noisy equipment in specially designed rooms. I began by asking Edson to take us back 25 years to describe what computers were like and what was starting to happen.
That was really the time in which people started to try to make computers a little more friendly. I think you'd have to go a little bit further back than there to get to the monsters in the glass houses that were built out of vacuum tubes and required enormous air conditioners and power plants to run them. But in the early to mid-60s, people were beginning to recognize that the user needed to be able to interact with the computer on a more regular and real-time kind of basis, that it wasn't enough to take your deck of cards to the glass house and then to come back the next day and get your results. That you sort of wanted to interact with this process as it was going on. And people in those days began to connect some very strange devices to computers. The one which was actually most popular in those days was the teletype machine. Teletypes, of course, are virtually obsolete these days, with fax having replaced it almost universally. But back in the early 60s, teletypes were an important method of communication for organizations with some of their dispersed entities, subsidiaries, and whatnot. And it became a very easy device to connect to a computer. So you could kind of sit down at your teletype machine, and you could either type data at it and get results back immediately, and as you saw that, perhaps alter what you were doing, or you could punch it out on paper tape and read it in a little later. This was all incredibly slow, unfortunately. The teletype machines generally went at 10 characters a second, so you really had to wait a while to get all this done, and obviously later technology has really sped it up. The mini-computer revolution, which was really when I started in the industry in the early 60s, basically had the concept that computers had ought to be associated with the project as opposed to being associated with an organization. Previously, an organization would have some enormous computer, and then somebody doing a project could bring their data there and come back with results. Unfortunately, a number of the applications required one to physically connect some type of device to the computer in order for it to acquire data or to be able to output to that device. And that didn't really work very well where the computer was being shared by lots and lots of different projects. So many computers were kind of designed for an individual project to have their own. It was a small machine. It was very friendly in terms of interconnection. And a user didn't need to worry about disturbing somebody else's work or somebody else's data as they went about using this device.
I particularly like the name mini-computer because at the time we were coming off of larger computers, and these were smaller computers, therefore they were minis. And now, of course, we realize the mini computers are much larger than anything we'd call a personal computer today, much less a handheld.
Well, there was something else going on in the world at the time those got named, which I think had an awful lot to do with it. And as you may remember, back in the early 60s, in London in particular, miniskirts became very popular. and the mini prefix began to get attached to lots of things, and computers was one of them.
Well, you were an engineer at the time at Digital Equipment Corporation, or DEC, as we call it. How did you come to set off on your own, and how long did that take?
Well, I was very fortunate. I guess being in the right place at the right time always helps. I started at Digital in 1961, and I worked there for 7 years. Strangely enough, during my entire tenure at DEC, I never worked for the engineering department, even though I designed 3 computers. I started out working for a special projects group whose mission was to design hardware which was unique to a given customer. If a customer had a particular problem they needed solved that couldn't be handled by standard hardware, we'd design something special for them. And in working on one of those projects, in particular for the Atomic Energy Commission in Canada, it became pretty clear that this problem really could be solved a whole lot better by an extremely small computer than by a customized device. And so while we originally won that job based on the bid of a customized device, the customer agreed that if we wanted to build them a very small computer to meet the requirements of that, that would be acceptable. So with that kind of starting point, we went about designing a very small computer, which at that time was a 12-bit machine called the PDP-5. After having designed that machine, I then went to work for the sales department as a what's called today a systems engineer, basically a person who works with customers, helping them on technical issues related to the actual use of the company's products. And so I got the opportunity to travel around to see a bunch of customers, to see what they were using it for, and to get a feel for the opportunity. And after having then designed the successors to that product, which were the PDP-8 and the PDP-8i, I really felt that the opportunity was enormous, that the surface had been scarcely scratched, and that there was going to be a number of changes happening in that industry. For instance, in 1964, IBM introduced the System 360, which changed a couple of things. First off, it changed the fundamental quanta of data from the 6-bit characters of the past to the 8-bit bytes, which we still know today in personal computers. They also began to use monolithic integrated circuits. And up till that time, monolithic integrated circuits had been very expensive. They'd been used by the federal government for the space program and some military kinds of applications. But in the late 60s, the monolithic integrated circuit became cost competitive with discrete components and thus allowed the design of computers using those components. That made computers a whole lot smaller, and as such, a number of the packaging schemes that had been used in the past were no longer valid. So we saw an opportunity to, in effect, jump headlong into a number of new pieces of technology and new standards, which a number of the companies in the industry were having a difficult time adopting. Digital, for instance, had a broad line of machines based on 6-bit characters. They had a couple of 18-bit machines and a 36-bit machine and some 12-bit machines. And the thought of having to redo all that software and all those interfaces and incur the customer's wrath to change over to an 8, 16, or 32-bit machine was a little hard to take. And they weren't alone. A lot of people were going through that dilemma. They also had a lot of investment in manufacturing equipment that wired backplanes and did things like that. And this really didn't make any sense any longer with monolithic integrated circuits. So we saw an opportunity to jump into a market that I believed was growing at an incredible rate, and to incorporate into it some of the ideas which in that day were quite new.
Well, you still had to at some point walk across the line and leave DEC. That had to be a struggle. You didn't on a Tuesday afternoon, I suspect, say, well, you know, I think we ought to go do this and left, right? How'd you do it?
Well, our biggest concern really was in raising the money. You know, three of us were pretty experienced in the computer arts, and One of our partners was extremely talented and experienced, a marketing person. And so our real issue, we really had a great deal of confidence that we could build a product which was modern and conformed with what the market was looking for. We felt we understood the market. We felt we knew how to sell it. The real problem was raising the money, and I don't think that's unique. I think an awful lot of new startups run into that as their fundamental problem. Back in 1968, there really was not a very well-developed venture capital industry. That all came later. There were a few venture capital firms. Prime among them was American Research and Development, which 10 years prior to that time had sponsored Digital Equipment Corporation. So obviously they weren't a candidate for us. So the way we had to go about raising money was a little different. And frankly, I'd have to admit, I was not the prime mover in raising the money. That was Herb Richman, my partner and vice president of marketing. And Herb, in his travels, had come to know a number of individuals who had been successful in the electronics industry and were looking to make investments in young companies that they thought had promise. And so Herb managed to assemble a bunch of those people who we talked to, told them what we were doing, and after a while managed to convince them to send us some money.
I like it. It's a good part of the story. Now, there were four of you initially?
Yes, there were.
And that was, say, three engineers and a marketing person?
Yeah, I was an engineer. My partner Dick Soge was also an engineer. Henry Burkhart, who you'll probably recognize is now the chief executive of Kendall Square Research, was a software person, and Herb Richman was our marketeer.
How long did it take before you knew Data General was going to be successful?
We were convinced it was going to be successful right from the beginning. You know, you never know. There's always, you know, some risk, I guess, but we were basically optimists, and I think, like most entrepreneurs, we really didn't know what all the risks were. You know, they say that entrepreneurs would never form their companies if they really understood the problem in front of them. So ignorance, in a certain sense, is bliss. So we were just convinced that that everything was going to go well. We knew we had to really work hard at it. We didn't think that there was something that was going to happen by itself. But we felt we had a good team. We felt we understood what we were doing. And we just thought it was a matter of getting on with it and making it happen.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Edson DeCastro. He was founder and former CEO of Data General Corporation. What were the three smartest things you did and the three worst mistakes you made?
Well, I don't know if I can give you a precise count of three, but I think that there are a couple of things we did which were very important to our success. First was looking very carefully at the market and understanding what it was that was going on, what did customers want, and what were their economics. People obviously who were buying our equipment were doing it because it offered them a value, and so we had to understand that real well. Secondly, we tried very hard to hire a diverse group of talent. I guess the flip side of that is that hiring clones of yourself is usually a mistake. One of you is enough. Now what you want is a bunch of people who have different talents and different experiences and different abilities and different points of view. So we tried from the very beginning to broaden the group and to bring in people who had expertise in some of the other areas, in manufacturing and personnel management and publicity, and all of those things that a company has to do. And we soon learn that you're only successful as whatever it is you do the poorest. The company's kind of like a chain, you know, the weakest link will kill you. We also made sure the company had plenty of money. We raised considerably more money than we needed well in advance of the need. And so that allowed us to do the kinds of things which made sense for our customers. On the downside, I think that clearly the biggest mistake we made was in not recognizing and getting involved in the personal computer industry very early on. And that's one of those classic mistakes that companies seem to make, where they're so committed and so invested in the product and the marketplace and the general ways of operation that they've used for many years, that they just can't conceive that something fairly dramatically different can be the right way to do it. So we really missed that one, and that was a very costly mistake.
Well, today you've certainly become a captain of industry. You're involved with many new technologies. What are the technologies which interest you the most?
Well, today I'm spending most of my time in the biotechnology industry. And in a sense, that may be just a cast back to my past. I see an awful lot in biotechnology today, similar to the computer industry of 25 or 30 years ago. And I don't mean in terms of the technology itself, but in terms of some of the driving forces which are bringing that technology into the mainstream. Today, biotechnology is in its very early years, as computers were 25 to 30 years ago. But I think there are three very important forces which drive an industry. The first of those is a fundamentally important technology, one which has at its roots important scientific discoveries that can be exploited to the benefit of many types of people. Secondly, you need a migration of very talented people into that industry. The computer industry in reality was driven by some awfully bright and capable people. And today in biotech, we see the same thing happening. We see people with real ability and real skills and real IQ moving toward that industry. And the third is the availability of sufficient capital in order to fuel the growth of that industry. And again, we see a similar kind of situation in biotechnology we saw in computers a number of years back, where investors are interested in biotech. That doesn't mean that they're throwing money at it like crazy in any harebrained scheme in the biotech industry will get financed. Investors, of course, are looking carefully and are investing only where they see real value. But in fact, it is possible to raise money for good, viable biotechnology ventures. So with all of those factors in place, I think that we have the makings of an industry that's just going to explode in the years ahead. The uses for biotechnology are incredibly diverse. They really touch virtually every field of human endeavor, from curing cancer to making toys. And I've really enjoyed my participation to date. I can't tell you I'm an expert. I am working with four biotechnology companies now as outside director and generally chairman to help them through some of the business issues. And in the meantime, I'm trying to absorb as much as I possibly can from the scientists to understand better the nature of the technology. And I must admit, just the learning process has been fascinating.
Are biotech companies, by their nature, very much different than computer technology companies?
I don't think so. There are some who believe that they are. And one difference I should point out is that scientists who frequently do the technical work in biotechnology companies are indeed different from engineers, or the discipline they practice is different. Scientists have generally been doing fundamental research in order to discover important information about nature. Engineers take important information that's been discovered and apply it to real-life problems. So from that aspect, I think you find there are certain differences. People tell me that scientists cannot, in fact, become CEOs, or should not, in fact, become CEOs of biotech companies. I don't really believe that. And in fact, the very first biotechnology company that I got involved in, Zenometrics, we conducted a search for a CEO, and we interviewed some fairly talented people, and I ultimately came away concluding that the scientist who was leading the technology was, in fact, the best person to be CEO. Now, this particular individual, I think, had some very unique skills and abilities, but I don't subscribe to the concept that scientists in biotechnology can't be CEOs. I think that clearly there are some people who have those skills and some who don't, but the blanket kind of indictment, I think, is dead wrong. I think, though, that there are some personality traits which may, in fact, make it difficult for some people. I mean, there are some people who just plain don't enjoy dealing with other people, and I think that makes it very difficult. I think that you need a person who is interested in communicating with other people, who likes to share his ideas and likes to work in collaboration with others. And there are many, many scientists who do that, who work collaboratively very effectively and who can communicate their ideas in the technical symposia very clearly. And those people, I think, have the root skills to ultimately be CEOs if they so desire.
Now, other than improving collaboration and communication skills, you've had both training and experience in both engineering and business. And simply to say, well, get some business training if you want to go out, if you're an engineer or a scientist and want to go out on your own, it doesn't really quite do it to say, go get some business training. What would a budding entrepreneur really need to know about business?
Well, obviously, as with anything, a certain amount of formal education can be helpful. As you mentioned earlier, I did spend a year at the Harvard Business School, and I'd have to tell you that I think I learned more in that year than in any other year of my education, although I didn't realize it at the time. It took me a few years to recognize the real value of that learning experience. So some degree of academic business education, I think, is useful. I think the other advantage that an entrepreneur can have is to work with a senior person who has had some experience. And frankly, that's the role that I'm trying to fill in some of these biotechnology companies, is to work with CEOs who have not had the opportunity to be formally educated on the business side or to have any experience, to just work with them through some of the problems. And the people, at least that I've been involved with, are so bright that they seem to absorb that very rapidly. And, the question they had today, they're an expert at tomorrow. And that's exactly what I'm trying to do with them.
My guest today is Edson DeCastro. He's an engineer, an entrepreneur, as well as a recipient of the Harvard Business School Alumni Achievement Award. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Do you see a responsibility in the area of, say, the biotech companies, since they can move forward in so many areas, while some of them are fairly controversial, is there a responsibility to society to pursue biotechnology?
Well, I think that science in general has a responsibility to society. I don't think I'd limit it to biotechnology. I think there are many areas of science where, if practiced in a proper way, it can be very advantageous. Science historically has been subject to political control, and we've seen that in many areas. What we've also seen is that at the end of the day, inhibiting the progress of science is usually not very smart and is usually ineffective. If it's inhibited in one place, it will spring up elsewhere. You can go back to the Chinese Empire during the Middle Ages, where the rulers decided that the use of sailing ships was an abuse of technology and forbid them to build sailing ships, and thus developed a very isolationist kind of society for many years. And I'm not sure that was good. In fact, sailing ships got built in other parts of the world, and the other parts of the world moved ahead fairly rapidly. So trying to turn off technology and to turn your head and say, some of these things, we ought to act as if they can't be done, I think is a big mistake. I do think that the political process has a real responsibility in seeing to it that the science is regulated and directed in ways that are beneficial over the long term to society, but trying to contain it in a bottle isn't going to work. The world just doesn't work that way, and if we don't face up to those problems, somebody else will.
One technology I know you're involved in, it's a fairly new one to me, it's not biotech, are personal travel technologies. Can you tell us a little about what's coming down the pike on that?
Yes, Personal Travel Technologies is a software company, and they have developed a extremely easy-to-use software package for people on the go, basically for travelers. And that software package, in effect, compiles all of the data that you'd find in a city map and in a travel guide in a way which allows a traveler to easily access it. For instance, if you're in the city of San Francisco and you're staying at the Mark Hopkins Hotel and you happen to be out of cash and you want to know where the nearest ATM is that has connected to the network that you belong to, you can find that information very rapidly from the personal travel guide on your laptop or a notebook or even palm top computer. If you happen to want directions on how to get to some address within the city, you can simply input your current location, and that can be either in terms of an address or a point of interest, such as the hotel, and give it the address that you want to go to. And it will then give you directions for a number of modes of travel. First off, if you're driving, it will give you driving directions, and it will say that you should travel west on some particular road for 3 blocks and then take a right on some other road and go for a quarter of a mile until you see the freeway entrance and so on. In doing that, it takes into account one-way streets, streets with turn restrictions where you can't make a left or a right turn, and it also takes into account on-ramps and off-ramps from freeways. If you ask it for walking directions, it will give you a slightly different cut at that because it knows that you can walk in any direction you like on a one-way street or you can make turns however you like, but that you can't go up on the freeway. So it'll give you walking directions. If you happen to be in a city that has public transit, it will direct you to the nearest bus stop and tell you which line to take and how many stops you need to go. And if you need to make a change, you can do that. So this makes traveling through a city for somebody unfamiliar with that city very easy and painless.
I'm struck by what an enormous amount of data this represents.
It does. The fundamental database is substantial, and we obviously take advantage of the latest technology and compression of that data. But at its heart, this product has a map of the city with all of the geographic coordinates, the length and shape of the streets. It knows where the addresses are, so it can get you to the right point for a given address. And it also has a database of all of the restaurants, the hotels, the points of civic interest, automatic teller machines, gas stations, any place that a traveler could want to go. And that is a lot of data. And frankly, that's one of the major efforts personal travel technology is undertaking, is the gathering of all that data for the cities.
I've read more than once where you've been called the father of the mini computer. How does that feel?
Well, I guess I'm obsolete these days. Most people feel that mini computers are kind of like dinosaurs. Having been.
How old are you, Edson?
I'm 55.
So yeah. How does it feel? Do you feel like a dinosaur?
Not really. I feel that sure, mini computers are in fact dinosaurs, but I've long since moved on to other things. And, I think you just got to keep yourself moving in towards the areas that are young and vibrant.
Mr. DeCastro, Edson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Moira. I've enjoyed it.
My guest today has been Edson DeCastro. He was founder and CEO of Data General and a key player in the evolution of computer technology. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Seagate Technology is the largest manufacturer of disks and disk storage drives, a component essential to storing data on every computer. Today, Seagate is expanding its vision to encompass all of data technology. I was able to speak with Al Shugart, founder and president of Seagate, and with Steve Lusso, senior vice president of corporate development, who is responsible for acquiring companies to assist in implementing this new vision. Al Shugart has had a career in data storage technology which spans 30 years. I began by asking him to compare how much physical space it takes to store data today as opposed to when he first began working in this area.
Yeah, that's really an interesting point because when I started in the disk drive business, we were able to record 2,000 bits in a square inch. And the number now is around 250 million bits in a square inch. That's where we've come.
That's amazing. Seagate has always been known as sort of the disk drive company. And today we're changing vision. Why is that?
You're right. We have always been known as a disk drive company. I think that we're in a larger kind of industry. I call it the data technology company. Things that have happened in the last 10 years in disk drives and in data storage and also in microprocessors have brought the price of computing down tremendously, and I think that's opened up opportunities for companies to broaden their view and broaden their revenue base. And now is the right time to do that, I believe, because of the fact that businesses are now taking advantage of these lower-cost storage devices and lower-cost microprocessors. And they're doing business a little differently, and we are financially very strong, have a good management structure, excellent management structure, a good trade name. We should expand.
Now, you have had some tremendous successes acquiring companies along the way. Is some of the idea to go out and acquire more companies, or are you just developing technology from within?
I'd like to have Steve Lusso talk to that because we just hired him for that sort of thing. It's called corporate development, and he's a senior vice president of corporate development. But I'd like him to talk about it. We have had six or seven acquisitions in our history, and they've all been successful, some very small, some very large, or at least one very large anyway. And I think we've become good at not only doing the acquisition but also the follow-through and execution after the acquisition, which many times is equally important, if not more important, than the actual acquisition. So maybe we should let Steve talk about the acquisition plans.
Yeah, I think if we look at the three elements of the business that we want to grow at Seagate, the hardware side, which we want to grow significantly, the components business that we want to grow, and then the software side, we're starting really at different points on each one of those businesses. And I would say clearly on the software side, since Seagate doesn't have a presence in the software business, we will be pursuing an active acquisition strategy, and that could span from little companies to big companies, just depending on the opportunities that present themselves and how it fits into the overall plan that we're putting together.
Well, I did know that you had acquired Caltex just a few weeks ago. Why do you want to get in the software business? You've done so well in disk drives.
I'd like to have Steve address that, too. I put the vision together, and now it's up to Steve to set the strategies to meet the vision. I'll let him talk about that.
Well, I think that probably the easiest way to think about it is there's little doubt that the amount of information that's being stored digitally today is huge and has been expanding year over year for the last, probably the last 30 years, but it's really accelerated, obviously, in the last 5 years, as Al just talked about, the amount of capacity that's on a little disk drive. And with all that information out there in storage, there are huge opportunities to manipulate and move and analyze that information for all of us to basically live better lives. And whether or not that's entertainment games or building products faster or being able to analyze business trends so people can respond quicker and avoid layoffs. I mean, all of it is good stuff, and the real point is how do you use that information more efficiently than we're using it today. And there's a hardware aspect to that in terms of faster processors and more storage, and people have done a great job at pushing that technology, increasing the price performance year over year. But we are now moving to the point that the networks involved in storing that data and the ability to use that data is really coming down to a software solution. You have to have people that can code well, code quickly, and code cheaply, and it's all about manipulating that data, which is really software. So it's a very high-growth business that has a lot of value add to it, and Seagate's one of the few companies that's strong enough to basically broaden its business base and move into some of those markets.
So in terms of the data technology, we're going to add on to the basic storage capability and the components which Seagate has developed, and we're going to move into the full complement with the software itself.
Yes, I think that in describing what is the data technology company, and we would describe it as a company that has technology-based products in data-intensive environments, and that's about as short a description of the data technology company that I could come up with.
But let me warn you, now you're going to have a lot of programmers, Al, and you're going to hear it's 98% done every week.
<That's great.
laughs> Let me tell you. Now let's go back a bit. How did you come to start Seagate? How did you really know it was going to happen?
Well, I didn't know it was going to happen, and I didn't know it was going to get so big. Perhaps if I had known it was going to get so big, I wouldn't have started it. I don't know. It got out of hand. I started Shugart Associates in 1973, and I was there for 2 years, and we made floppy disk drives. And then I left Shugart Associates and just bummed around and did things like commercial fish, and I owned a bar in Santa Cruz. In fact, I moved to Santa Cruz and had a good life going. I was doing some business consulting and technical consulting along with it. And then I decided I should go back to work, and probably the catalyst for that is I got remarried.
Yes.
And I called my wife, Rita, and she laughs about this, so I don't mind telling it on the air. She's the ultimate consumer, so I had to go back to work. And Finest Connor came to me with the idea when I was looking for something to do, the idea of replacing multiple floppies, which is the only storage, mass storage that, besides tape drives, that personal computers had, or those days they didn't even call them personal computers. And it was Finest's idea to build a hard disk drive that stored a lot of data in the same size as the mini floppy. And I thought that was a great idea, and so Finest and I went out to raise some money, and it went from there.
All right, so now you have over 150 products in terms of disk drives. That just, I can't fathom that. How do you keep track of all this?
We have a fantastic workforce. And the management team is fantastic, and all the way down to the direct labor. I think the people at Seagate are just fantastic. We have manufacturing kinds of operations in 15 locations around the world. We are a worldwide company, all the way from a plant in Scotland to a plant in Penang, Malaysia, and Singapore, and so forth. We do manufacturing in the United States also. We have about 40,000 people. We have about 200 products instead of 150. But
see what happens when you look at
it's grown very well. It's one of the things that I think that's helped us over the years since we acquired Imprimis, which was the disk drive division of Control Data. Prior to that acquisition, Seagate only made the lower capacity, lower performance disk drives directed towards the PC market. And Imprimis made the higher capacity, higher performance drives for higher performance computers, and when we merged, the result was a complete line of disk drives, and that's helped immensely. Of course, the fact that the Nipperbus also had a thin film head capability was probably, in the back of my mind, the key.
A little attractive. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Al Shugart, he's the President and CEO of Seagate Technology, and Steve Luso, Senior VP for Corporate Development. Now, you have talked about your production sites. I know you've got 6 in the United States and 7 overseas. How should American technology businesses and Americans think about overseas labor and American jobs?
Well, first of all, I don't think that a company, and certainly not Seagate, moves offshore for as a result of the availability of low-cost direct labor, because direct labor is too small a part of the entire equation to make that the criteria. There's a lot of things that add up to being to moving a plant wherever it might be. I mean, moving a plant from California to Nevada would have the same kinds of thinking that goes into it. And it's all bottom-line kind of stuff, but it involves more than just direct labor. There's all the overhead that goes with building a product, the infrastructure of the location where you're building, the government situation in the particular location you're at, tax situation, import, export, all those things go into the bottom line that says where you should be, if you should be in a particular location or not. So it's not just direct labor.
Okay, so the businesses are looking at all of those factors going in, and the Americans standing there saying, gee, did we miss the boat? Could we have kept it here? Should we have kept it here? What do you think about that?
I think it's entirely possible that the government should have looked at specific technology areas and decided that yes or no, that was worthwhile making an investment in giving incentives to keep that technology local. And I don't think the government did that.
So just in the case of cities like the city of San Francisco, where we've had a great exodus of businesses because of some of the city and county laws that were passed, that's true of countries and internationally. So I think what you're saying is if we want to keep the jobs and the production sites here, we need to look at that at a government level.
Yeah, we do, but also we can't have government intervention. It's more the other side is even worse when the government when government intervenes. That really ruins a lot of incentives. But on the other hand, we do a lot of things in the United States. We have over 9,000 people located in the United States. We do some manufacturing. All of our product development, or most of our product development in disk drives, is done in the United States, and all of our product development in magnetic heads and magnetic disks is done in the United States. So there are opportunities for growth in the disk drive area within the United States. The production facilities that we've put together offshore, if we'd have left those onshore, we wouldn't be in business.
Now, Steve, what emerging technology companies, not the companies themselves, but the emerging technologies, are you looking for? And do you expect those to be in the United States or overseas?
I think in the software area, what Al calls data management, which I think is a good name for a broad group of software areas, which kind of breaks down into storage management software or network management software or document management. Those are all three pretty well-defined areas that really relate to how do you store data the most efficiently and how do you move it over a network the most efficiently so the user gets the data when the user needs it and there's not systems going down in the meantime. And this is particularly important now that commercial or businesses are moving to a client-server type architecture as opposed to a real mainframe-dominated architecture. So in those three areas, there are several companies that are providing nice solutions. It's a very fragmented market right now because the shift to client-server in the commercial marketplace is just starting to happen. On the technical side, it's in the technical workplace, manufacturing and aerospace and automotive design, it's been much more pervasive. But it's a good market with a lot of companies. And for the most part, those are U.S.-based companies. The U.S. has, I think, a very strong leadership position in software in general, and in particular in the advanced system software, these client-server type architectures. It's definitely got the lead on the rest of the world. So most of the companies will be domestic in terms of where they're located, but the markets which they will serve will certainly be worldwide, because the computing trends that you see in the United States are going to happen in Europe, maybe with a little bit of a lag, and then they will certainly happen in Asia with probably another lag.
What about the hardware side? Are you staying in hard disk drives?
Absolutely. Not for a second are we going to take the eye off the ball on the disk drive side, which is one of the reasons why someone like myself is brought in, as opposed to taking management time away from the existing management at the company. We certainly intend on remaining the largest and most successful disk drive company, but we also want to leverage our manufacturing capabilities there. That could include other types of storage devices, or it could include other types of products that we believe will be high volume. whether or not it's tape drives or optical or CD-ROMs or even some consumer products or flat panel displays. Those are all areas that we want to take a look at. And, for example, in the area of flat panel displays, there could be a real opportunity to take some of that market share back from the Japanese companies, which have done very well there, and bring some of that back to the United States, because there's some new technologies that are really interesting.
It seems like, in a sense, you're getting, while you still have your eye on the ball, in terms of we're not going to walk away from discs and disc drives, goodness, that's what got us here.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the vision is sort of moved up a level to say, what's the total vision? Is that sort of some metaphor for companies to live in Silicon Valley? They have to kind of take their eye off a little bitty component and say, no, I got to look at a bigger picture? Or is that a function of how big Seagate has become?
No, I don't. I think it's not a function of how big Seagate's become. I think that every company needs a vision, and the vision has to emanate from the boss, and everybody's got to buy into it. And we have been growing our company in disk drives for a long time, and we started re-engineering our company 2 years ago, and after a year of getting things in place, I started to think about what kind of business are we really in and how are we going to grow this company beyond just growing and making sure we're the best disk, continue to be the best disk drive company. And I concluded we're in the data technology business. And so my vision saw us growing disk drives, growing other kinds of hardware by from our present $3 billion a year level to $4 billion in 1999. So that's part of the vision. I envision growing our component revenues from the current level of about $100 million a year to about $1 billion in 1999. And I envision our data management software growing from the present zero to $1 billion in 1999. So Al's 1999 vision is a $6 billion company, which is roughly twice our size now. And we hired Steve to figure out how to do that.
I think it really is a good metaphor for the companies that are in the valley. Technology companies have the advantage of the fact that the world is changing, you know, so quickly that there's great new markets being opened up and great opportunities. And from my background, where I spent a lot of time advising the major systems companies, not only in the Valley but really across the United States, all of them who are strong and either have a leadership position in their own markets by virtue of financial resources or, in most cases, technology and management, are looking at ways to expand their businesses into other markets, because it's nice to grow within your own market, but then you're always limited by the growth of that market, and what you really want to do is to leverage your assets. You want to continually leverage your assets if you can, and all the strong companies, whether or not that's Microsoft or Intel or Oracle or Silicon Graphics or Hewlett-Packard, they all have strategies in place to broaden what they're doing, and Seagate, fortunately, is the one disk drive company that is in the position to be able to do that, and we'd be crazy not to do it.
My guest today are Al Shugart, he is President and CEO of Seagate Technology, and Steve Luso, Senior VP for Corporate Development. Now, Al, I'm going to take you back here. When I was getting ready for this interview, I suddenly remembered 1967, the summer of love. Now, you know, everybody else is a hippie. I was buried in a computer room 30 miles away in Palo Alto. I thought I was at the center of the universe. This is a little how engineers can get lost when the rest of the world marches on. And I was 18, and I had a summer job at Syntex Labs. And in the basement was Allen Babcock Computing. They had an IBM 360 down there, which was this huge thing. And I remember I was allowed to go in the computer room. And, of course, I made friends with all the operators. Of course, now, in these days, I remember I was 18, and I wore a miniskirt. And, you know, I can remember why they were friendly with me. This is no longer the case. And I looked over, and I saw this device, and it had this carousel. It's about my height and maybe a couple of feet wide, and a carousel, and had that went around and stopped, and these strips came out and wrapped around its disk.
Yeah.
And I looked over, and I said, what is that? It was fascinating. And the operator said to me, that's the data cell. And here I am looking at your background, and it says you're manager of a number of IBM developments, including the data cell. Was that the data cell?
Yeah, that was the IBM data cell drive, yes.
Yeah,
that was an exciting project.
Tell us a little about that.
The DataCell drive had been in product development in the early, gosh, I guess it started even in the late 50s, and it had been in product development for 8 years, and it never had been a success. It never really worked very well. And we did an audit, the research part of IBM did an audit on the state of the strip file, because it's a very complex device. Got to pull one strip out of a whole bunch and wrap it on a drum and read it and then stuff it back in, like putting a noodle back into the box. And it was never going to work. But so the research people took a look at the audit of the program and said it was not possible. I love a challenge like that. And so I was asked if I wanted to take on the program, and I took two of my best friends, a mechanical engineer and electrical engineer, and I said, you guys think we can make this thing work? And they said, yeah. And sure enough, 3 years later, we announced the DataCell drive, and it was 400 million bytes, and those were in days when the average disk drive was about 5 million bytes. So it was a big hierarchical storage device for unloading your disk drive into a cheaper form of storage. And each DataCell was removable, too. And so there were, I think, 20 data cells, so each data cell had 20 million bytes of data on it. Fun project.
Oh, it was great. It was great to look at.
It's fun to watch.
There's nothing to watch now. Everything's all inside, you know. You really saw this drum running around. And
great thing was that we proved the research guys wrong. We actually did it. It worked.
I see that little mischievous elf in there, Al. Now, is working on a project like that and working on the technology today any different?
Oh, no. It still takes the same kind of mind. It's probably easier nowadays because the young engineers that come out of college are so much smarter, and there's so much more assistance. Gee, when I was an engineer designing things, we used to design our own circuits. And now you look up in the book to see which chip from which manufacturer does the things you want to do, and you buy the chip. So it's a lot easier from that standpoint, but it takes the same kind of person.
Let's get back to the data technology company vision. Are you going to have to retrain any of your employees to go along with this vision, or is this just an expansion of where you are?
I don't think we have to retrain any employees. I think our employees have an awful lot to do right now. And as Steve mentioned a little earlier, I think from an acquisition point of view, if we acquire some things, the two things we're looking for, and number one in my mind is it has to be technology, and number two, it has to have good management.
Now, we're going to have to say, Steve, while he only has worked at Seagate for a couple of weeks now, I guess, he's actually been working with you guys for years. So it's not just he's the new guy going to solve everything, right?
No, he knows our company very well. He's been advising us for some time.
Well, has he been on board long enough for him to answer this question? When do you spell disk, D-I-S-K, and when do you spell it D-I-S-C?
It's always spelled D-I-S-C.
By everybody?
By Seagate.
Okay.
Well, there's a good story about that, or if you'd like to hear it.
I was hoping you'd tell me.
when we started Seagate, our original funding came from a company called Dysan here in the valley, in Silicon Valley. They made floppy disk and a few other things, and Norm Dion put money in the company, the first $500,000. And we did it all on a handshake, by the way. There wasn't any documentation. But one of the agreements was if he put money in, we would spell disk with a C because Dysan spelled disk with a C. And we've spelled it with a C ever since because we had that handshake.
So
total story.
We got to find him to see why he spells it D-I-S-C. Now, you have 40,000 employees, Al. How many of those people do you actually know?
I know more than you'd think I know. I go see these employees, most of them anyway, every 3 months. I tour all the facilities around the world, and I miss people that are on the fourth shift or people that aren't at work that day. But I have about 26 or 27 presentations I make every quarter. I show people how we did financially for the prior quarter. Give them a little information on other things in the company and answer questions. And I do this every 3 months around the world, and so I end up knowing an awful lot of people. I can't talk to all the people in the Far East because those plants are too big. There are more people in a shift change in our Teprock, Bangkok plant than lived in my hometown. So I can't talk to everybody, but I get to most of them.
What are people in Silicon Valley, and by that I mean business people, How are they going to have to think differently coming into the mid to late 90s now?
Well, that's a real good question, and I'm not sure I know. I think the world has become a very cost conscious, and you have to do a lot of what they call now re-engineering. You have to really look at how you do business and don't do things that you shouldn't be doing. Do things smarter, and you have to become a real focused international kind of company, I think. Beyond that, I'm not sure what the secret is. Perhaps if I knew the secret, I wouldn't share it with you anyway.
I like that honesty. What were the three worst mistakes you made in Seagate, the three best ideas you had?
Oh, boy. Well, of course, the best idea was to start. That had to be.
That's a good idea.
I guess the second best was to get Norm Dion and Dysan to be our original investor. I think that was a real smart thing. And I guess the third one had to be the purchase of Imprimis.
How about the mistakes?
I hate...
Come on, Al.
There haven't been any mistakes.
Can't think of one. But I'm sure there have been, but my...
What about that guy you dumped 3 years ago?
But I have my... my mental makeup is that as soon as I've made a mistake and have done whatever I have to do to fix it, I put it in the waste paper basket and never think about it again.
You look at it positively, the lesson you learned.
Yeah, learn from it.
Now, I was reading some different articles about you, Alan. Every one of them, some point in the articles, they say, he's gruff. Al, do you think of yourself as gruff?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I don't either.
Unpolished, maybe, but not gruff.
Oh. That's terrific. In the end, what's it going to take to sell the vision internally to these 40,000 people? And, of course, that's going to be growing as well.
Yeah, I think that's really a key question. And what's important about it is that all of the senior management of the company, as well as the board, is committed to the plan, if you will, the idea of making this a broader company and making it the data technology company. So a lot of the hurdles you run into when you're trying to pursue some sort of growth strategy in terms of people saying, no, I'm afraid because I want to just stay in my own little backyard, these people realize the benefit of moving beyond what we're doing right now, but also realize the importance of keeping their eye on what we're doing because that's what's fueling the growth. And without those elements, it's really tough. And now the real goal is to communicate that message throughout the organization, which we're going to actively do over the next couple of months. In fact, I'm going to go to the Far East with Al in just a couple of weeks and continue to spread the message.
The vision was put together by me probably 9 months ago, so this isn't something brand new. In fact, we've been talking about it for the last 9 months, and we've been slowly getting people to understand. We've been using now the data technology company as a tagline for about 6 months. People have ignored it, and all of a sudden now they're beginning to see it. And we've slowly built up, and I've been talking to the employees about the data technology company for 6 months, so this is nothing new. They're waiting anxiously, awaiting to hear more. And everybody buys into the concept of what we're trying to do, and they're eager to hear more. So I think it's going to be very, really, really good to have Steve go with me around to the employee meetings and put some meat on the bones of the data technology company.
Al, Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
My guests today have been Al Shugart, he's President and CEO of Seagate Technologies, and Steve Lusso, the Senior VP for Corporate Development. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.